Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, welcome back to Deep Dish Radio. I'm Tim Powers, and this is my show. Thanks very much for sticking with me. My guest today is Slim Jim Phantom, drummer for arguably one of the best bands to come out of the 1980s, the Stray Cats, which almost single-handedly brought rockabilly back. And really, really, some great music came out of them. And if you're listening to this show, you darn well ought to know about who the Stray Cats are. Jim has put out his autobiography called My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel, A Stray Cat Strut by Slim Jim Phantom. Get it wherever you get your books. In it, Jim tells the story about how he fell in love with the drums, how he, what it was like being one of the Stray Cats, and what a long, strange trip it's been, a marriage to Britt Eklund, production by Dave Edmonds, friendship with one of the Beatles. Jim's had an incredibly amazing and charmed life, and I got to tell you, easily one of the most fun interviews I've ever done. So sit back, strap in, and take part in the wild ride that is Slim Jim Phantom, which is coming up right after this. If you like the show, I encourage you to help me out and go to iTunes and leave me a 5-star review right now. That's the best way for people to find out about this show. Just boost the ratings and let people know that you like what you hear. Leave a review, leave a comment, which certainly wouldn't hurt. And then take the show and tweet it out to your friends. Post it on your Facebook page. Let everybody know what you're hearing here on Deep Dish Radio so that I can attract more and more fun guests and I can spend more time doing this. It's a pleasure doing this for you, and our audience has grown significantly over the last few weeks. Thank you very much, and really appreciate that. This is so much fun for me. I hope it's fun for you too. So, that being said, ladies and gentlemen, Deep Dish Radio, proud to present Slim Jim Phantom.
So I've had a very, charmed life, and I'm, it's the middle of the day, I'm watching the Yankee game, and I'm,
I can dig it. You are my second guest to open for the Stones. Larry Tamblyn from the Standells opened for the Stones in 66, and you opened 20 years later, which is awesome.
They're even older than me, right?
Yeah.
Standells, Dirty Water.
Yeah, Dirty Water.
They're also on the Munsters.
Yeah, that's right.
Hope you talked about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And their drummer was one of the Mouseketeers.
Really?
Dickie Dodd.
Ah. See, I always felt bad about that. Those guys, they're like on a TV show, and then they had to play the Beatles songs. Like,
yeah. they cried all the way to
the
bank.
The Beatles got paid again. It was,
Yeah.
I think they did I Want to Hold Your Hand, or, one of the, big hits of the day. They didn't do their own song.
Yeah, no kidding. But I don't know. They had an interesting career. I'll send you your publicist a link to the episode if you want to check it out. It's really cool. He's a good egg.
I love those guys. I've got their an album came out a few years ago, on the Nuggets series, I think. Garage Rock. I have a whole Standells album.
Is that the L.A. Nuggets set? The Where the Action Is set.
Yeah, I think, and I think they did something to do with the Standells as well.
Yeah.
I think they were on some, and I have an LP, a vinyl one, of all, an album of theirs.
Oh, so, yeah, it's good stuff. It's really good stuff. They played at when the Nuggets box came out. They did a concert at Amoeba. It was them and the Peanut Butter Conspiracy and Jackie DeShannon and P.F. Sloan. Man,
yeah,
crazy.
You know, Jackie DeShannon's still around. She's she's a correspondent because I'm going to do this weekend. I'm going to do Breakfast with the Beatles.
You're doing Chris Carter's show.
Because I have a chapter about George Harrison, who was like a, I don't want to say covert, but like a friend of mine, like not on the radar kind of thing, you know?
Right.
And I never really talk about these things until I did the book, because I'm at one point I said, why am I just giving everything away all the time? They steal the music. They say, my stories I'm going to keep for myself until I can at least, you know, get a good gig out of it, you know, something to do it myself, not to just tell stories all the time. So I called Chris just out of the blue. I'm trying to think out of the box a little bit,
right?
Because the publishers, they have the, you know, the set things that they call and they do, and that's their world. But I thought, how can I go out of the box? I just cold called Chris Carter. And he said, what a great idea, because there's a whole chapter about George. And, we can make that into an hour, playing Beatles songs and talking about, you know. So Jackie DeShannon is a correspondent on the show.
Right. Yep. I'm in Eagle Rock, man. I'm a listener to Carter's show, too. In fact, I'm probably going to see you Wednesday night at Book Soup.
Oh, because the number came up from Rhode Island.
Oh, yeah. That's my studio line. But I'm up in Pasadena, the Eagle Rock, man.
Okay, I was just there yesterday. As a funny, you know, bit more of my wacky life, a good buddy of mine was in the Power Rangers, and they had the convention, the Comic-Con.
Oh, you were up at the RangerCon. That's funny.
Yeah. Steve Cardenas is a good buddy of mine, Rocky the Red Ranger, for 20 years, you know. And he bugs me to go to his things. He comes to mine. I finally went yesterday.
Cool.
There were like 2,000 people. No one cared about me. And then there was a girl who used to be on the show who I wound up knowing. We sat together. It was just a nice day, but I was in Pasadena.
Did you get recognized?
No. Nobody cared there.
Well, that's too bad.
Well, they got recognized when Steve Cardenas came and walked me through the lobby. Said, Rocky! You know, the shoe was on the other foot.
That's hilarious. Well, yeah. Listen, man, one of the things that I picked up, especially out of the first third of the book, is people say that luck is when opportunity meets preparation, right?
Yes.
And that's kind of what I got from the early days of the Stray Cats. You guys were just a Long Island band, and you're like, yeah, we could be bigger than this, and you kind of knew, and took off to England, and everything kind of took off. Can you kind of go through that story a little bit?
Well, this is 1979, 1980, I think. We were, you know, we found rockabilly at a certain age. We were all musician guys from the same school, really, same neighborhood. Brian's a couple years older. But we were all in school together, Little League, and we've known each other since, I don't know, 7 years old,
right?
Really that long. And everyone was musicians, and we kind of knew each other. Lee and I played together a lot, and Brian we knew, again. And we all kind of found rockabilly around the same time. We were into the blues and into glam rock and into a bunch of things. Punk rock had just come, and we, you know, somehow got through the filter of it all, rockabilly, and everyone was immediately turned on by it. Lee, Brian, and me, and we started doing what became the Stray Cats. It's almost like a fun thing, you know. And then it, because we're three guys that like to get dressed up, and we had a double bass, and you know,
right.
You know, expanding the frontiers a little bit, you know, getting minimalist and moving the drums up to the front of the stage, which no one had ever done. There's been small drum kits. There might even be a couple of like ancient ones where someone stood up, but one thing I positively know is that no one ever put the drums in the front of the stage before.
Right.
Even, you know, big band guys, my idols, Buddy Rich and Gene Krupa, they were still a little bit behind the band, you know. There was a second line. That's what it comes from, you know, second line musicians or the drummer. But so we were playing around, and we were trying to get ahead. We would go and play New York City once a month, CBGB's, Max's, where I was trying to get a record deal, hoping someone was in the audience kind of thing, you know, to get. But then during the week, we played bars on Long Island that the big music venues wouldn't have us because it was too weird. You think about 1979, and we're like in pink suits and high hair, and you know, just didn't want to know about anything else.
Right, people are just coming off disco, and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't even New York City, or it wasn't, you know, anywhere groovy at all. We were on, and we stuck to our guns. We dressed that way 24/7, went around together, and it was almost like having to fight for the right to look a certain way, you know. But at night, we would play these little bars, and we couldn't get booked at the big rock clubs. Like I said, they were like still, you know, it was very much Southern rock and heavy metal, and you know, whatever was around 1979. So, So we would booked our own gigs at these little, what we would call old man bars, corner bars and pubs in England, you'd call them, but, and that weren't even rock places, didn't even have stages. We would just find them. You know, there's a place up there on Sunrise Highway. Let's go to that place and see. And usually the bartender was the owner. You know, it was a dark place in the daytime, you know, that kind of. And we would just say, we'll play here Tuesday nights, and we'll bring our kids, and we'll, you know, all right, you guys just, you know, have some people here. We took the door, they took the bar. And we found five of these places scattered about Long Island in our area. There was one in Amityville, there was one in Belmore, there was one in Massapequa, there was one in Merrick. You know, so 5 days a week we played, and we played four sets a night. And we had a little gathering of people that weren't rockabillys. They were just like neighborhood people who kind of heard about us and would come around. So we'd have 100 people just turn up and be crazy for us. They protected us, and they, you know, we were the eccentric kind of guys, and they looked out for us. But we wanted to do something bigger, something a little bit more international. We kind of knew it was good, and that being on Long Island wasn't the way to go forward. So we kind of just left. We sold everything that we had, a couple of, you know, PA, like a little PA, and some drums, and an extra guitar kind of thing, and just went to England, because we heard about punk rock, and we got some magazines where that there was cool people there kind of thing.
Right.
Like, even in New York City, it was a very tiny alternative scene, you know. There was Max's and CBGB's, but I think 79, early 80, there was kind of Nowheresville everywhere. There was no, you know, scene for anything particularly. So we heard England was cool.
Right.
I don't know if we even thought about it more than 5 minutes. Okay. And we went. The three of us moved to England. We had, you know, all, you know, our clothes in a suitcase we all used to share, like who gets the bowling shirt that day, and who got the pink pants, and who got the, you know, just grab whatever you could. And we were pretty much homeless, you know. We slept in, you know, like Sid and Nancy, the squats like that. There
right.
was a few around. We found one, you know. We went into Soho, tried to knock on doors, and we wound up staying at X-rated theaters, because for a buck you could stay there 24 hours. And we were asleep. We were kids. We were sleeping in a, you know, like any normal kid would be watching the movie, you know.
Right.
We were, you know, we had nowhere to go, literally. So we knocked on enough doors, went to some parties, and tried to find out where, you know, groovy places were. And we knocked on doors and finally got a couple of gigs. This is maybe 3-4 months into it, being homeless. And we got a couple of opening act slots.
Right.
Pub, playing at a pub, 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But we had been around on the party scene trying to get in, telling everyone that we met about this band.
Right.
We're the greatest band in the world, but no one's ever heard us, and we have nowhere to live, and, you know, we're, so when we finally got these opening act slots, the word was out a little bit. Okay, let's just go see these guys, and they're not going to bother us anymore, and we can say we saw them. And then we played. And, okay, kids, you got 20 minutes. And there was Lemmy in the audience, and Steve Jones, and Chrissy Hynde, and Joe Strummer. Ooh. And, like, there was 10 people, but they were, like, 7 cool people that we had met at parties who,
right.
like, we pestered everyone so much that they came to see us kind of thing, you know? And then we only had to play. And this is where the, you know, the preparation comes in. We've been playing 4 sets a night, 5 nights a week. For a year in New York.
Right.
So when someone says, 20 minutes, kid, go, we wanted that opportunity.
And you had
the
tightest 20 in all London, huh?
Yeah. And so London was small, you know, it's a big place, but there was a music press and it was a small scene. So it took just, you know, one guy hearing about it to tell some guy at the music paper who said, hey, there's these three kids and they're homeless from New York and they're playing, you know, tomorrow. And it spread very quickly. Because of the audience, we had like 5 rock stars out of 10 people that were in the audience kind of thing, you know? And again, it's still people I speak to this day. We just saw Steve, you know, Lemmy was, you know, tough one. I just saw Chrissy Hynde where, like, Strummer was a tough one, but everyone's still friendly. It's funny,
right,
of a certain
right.
age and a certain scene. It's, everyone stays in touch. So when we had that opportunity, we really went for it. And, the time was right. In England too, there was a kind of in between scene. Like punk rock had just, you know, was like over. New wave was kind of over, and there was nothing in the void, kind of. And we stepped up with the very strong image as well. It was like rockabilly, but it was punk rock, and it was. We didn't really know. We just thought what was cool. You know, we thought anyone with any kind of haircut and any kind of clothing was cool against right. The squares, kind of thing. You know, so that kind of the innocence of it. And at this time, we're still 19 years old. That kind of came across.
Right.
And then when they saw, you know, the guy standing on the drum, wow, look at that giant band. And then they hear Brian play, and he's virtuoso. He's a special musician, you know.
Yeah, he's amazing.
It was just game over, you know. And then it really took meeting Dave Edmonds, who was the guy who could get it onto the tape, which we didn't really know how to do. But he was another one of the people in the audience.
Yeah, your record contract is interesting because, you know, it was everything but the U.S. And you would think that a place that would really embrace its own music, its own roots music, you know, the rockabilly, you know, Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran kind of sound, you know, we'd be hungry for that, especially coming off the heels of disco. Turns out we were, but in 1980, people didn't realize that. And your record deal didn't include the U.S.
No, it was an exclusive, you know, like it purposely said the U.S. company wasn't interested. Like it was a huge company, and you know, it has to pass the worldwide, you know. And the thing was his contract. We had a bunch of people after us. Richard Branson, who was fantastic, thought we were smashing good fun, you know, came to see us. I should have gone with him. In hindsight, we could have got maybe upgrades on the airline. But everyone wanted us because it was so kind of in the moment, you know. And the Rolling Stones came to see us, and you know, it was that world. It was happening in like small clubs, all these famous people to see us who just, but at the same time, it was groovy, and I loved meeting everyone and part, but we had no money. We were still kind of homeless.
Right.
And, you know, so when someone took you to lunch to court you for a record, we tried to drag it out for a month to get lunches every day kind of thing, you know. Oh, we're meeting with, who knows, Warner Brothers. Oh, okay, you know, that, you know. Hopefully to take us to lunch, you know. So when the people who came up with the money first is who we went with, kind of thing, and they were a good company. Arista, you know, they were fine, but they also had a U.S. division. The pretty famous people ran it, who chose not to have us on their label. So we went about it the opposite way. We went everywhere that they would take us. We went to France straight. We had like five straight number ones in France.
Right.
Germany, Holland, all over Europe, every country in Europe, and it was a huge scene. Japan, Australia, back to England, back to Europe. So by the time we got around to coming to the States, this is like 2-3 years later. We had been like having big hit records around the world, but we're American guy. We wanted to come back and play in the States, and we got someone bought the license, I think. From Arista.
Okay.
And they put it out here.
A small label?
Again, it was EMI.
Oh, okay.
And they, because Arista, I think, had the first right of refusal, and they passed kind of thing, and even though we had his records, they, again, make room on the soapbox for me, because this is what I've been saying for 30 years, it's American music, you know? And Keith Richards, say, who came to see us play and became, a friendly and all that, all he said to us, the first thing he says, all we did, man, was sell your music back to you.
That's He's what exactly it was, right.
You know? That, yeah. Of well, course, they, you know, the American people at the time and where we were, maybe some, you know, like a small scene, nobody knew Johnny Burnett or Carl Perkins. It really was American music that had been embraced. Because rockabilly itself was a very short-lived thing in the States, you know? Elvis, of course, was Elvis, and Buddy Holly got through a little bit. Jerry Lee went country. But as a movement, it wasn't nearly as big as, you know, the British Invasion or disco or new wave. It really wasn't that big of a movement, you know? And we loved it so much, and we went to the places where it came from, Norfolk, Virginia, and they didn't know who Gene Vincent was.
Wow.
In Texas, they didn't know who Buddy Holly was, you know? The movie came out, so a little bit Buddy Holly. But, you know, in general, and I still don't know, I don't even really know if it's important that 99% of the fans of the Stray Cats didn't know what it was. They just knew it was a band they liked, and that was, you know, popular, and it had a look. And so but it linked up perfectly with MTV.
That's where I was going to go, actually. Your image was just like custom made, built for MTV.
Yeah, which is, I think MTV is a fantastic pop cultural phenomenon, amongst the greatest things ever, I think. Really, it changed the world.
It changed your world. And,
yeah, well, I kind of think it changed everything, to be honest. It really changed the whole game, I think. And believe it or not, when MTV started, they needed content.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
They
didn't
have enough stuff.
I am the right age for the MTV generation. I was 13 in 1982.
Two videos.
Yeah.
That we had already made in England. Julian Temple, who did the, you know, the Sex Pistols film, he's like a big producer, you know.
Right.
He's really become like a successful mainstream guy. So he had done two videos for us, because in Europe you would show them on Saturday afternoon kind of shows, and, you know, it was a, there wasn't a music channel per se, but you used video a little bit. So anyway, we had two in the can. And when MTV started, they just needed stuff to play.
Right.
And we were on the road. This would have been the summertime, 1982. And radio was still kind of resistant, because it was still, again, it was, look at the charts in 1982.
Yeah, no kidding.
And like now, I like everything. But exactly at the time, we were fighting a little bit. And so MTV was playing things that were a little bit off the beaten path, because they needed stuff. So sometimes your clip would get played 10 times a day because they didn't have another one, kind of thing, you know?
Right.
So at that point, MTV started to dictate to radio. Like, radio couldn't ignore it anymore. So rather than, than MTV looking, well, it's on 100 stations, let's start playing it. It was the radio looking, wow, this thing's going to play 100 times a day on MTV. We better start playing this on our station.
Right.
And that's when I think the world changed for a lot of us who were alternative, I suppose, you know. And it was just a tailor-made image, I think, because we really combined it, like, a few things. And now if you look back to, like, that exact moment in time, 83, 84, it really made a dent. You know, the mannequins at Macy's had pompadours and they looked like bowling shirts on the, you know, we're in the poster in the back of John Waters and Pretty in Pink. We were the poster on the wall, kind of thing, you
right.
know, like 16 Candles, rather. But, you know, it kind of, for a brief moment there, became the mainstream.
And they drank you right in, man. You could pop into the studio whenever you wanted. You know, you guys kind of ran MTV for a while.
Everyone was friends, and that's something I'm pretty sure I talked about. We were friends with everyone. Martha Quinn was our friend, and Nina Blackwood, J.J. Johnson especially, Mark Goodman, Alan Hunter. We were friends, and I think they were friends with other bands too, not just us, but everyone would hang out.
Right.
Like, you'd go to New York, let's go to MTV, okay, and we'd just go there. And it was, again, they were happy to have people. You know, it was like a VJ and a potted plant behind them trying to find a video to play.
No kidding.
And everyone was really cool. It's really positive memories of that. And we were just on the road the whole time, and it clicked a little bit, you know. And what we were really excited about was the guys like Carl Perkins, Paul Burleson from Johnny Burnett, Jerry Lee. These people came out and Wanda Jackson, Sonny Burgess, they said, thank you, boys, for bringing this music back, because it really re-energized the rockabilly world. You know, that's, I mean, if you want to look at it, you know, when I was younger, I used to feel a little bit embarrassed by it all, but now I'm just calling it like I see it. All these compilations in rockabilly world came after the Stray Cats. I mean, they might have existed, a few of them, but in general, I think the whole world and those old original artists would be the first guys to tell you that their lives got kind of plugged in again.
It's the truth.
The kids found rockabilly, you know.
It's the truth, Jim. I'll tell you, I grew up in St. Louis, right? And
right. And
it took a while for the cats to get, you know, popular in St. Louis, but I loved Chuck Berry forever.
Totally. Yep.
And once you guys started hitting the charts, he started playing the clubs again. You know, and he started coming around, and he started having regular gigs in St. Louis, and it was fun to see him playing, just as kind of a reaction to the fact that people were paying attention to what came before the Beatles, thanks to you guys.
Yeah, and it's, again, no one bothered to ask the Beatles, I think. Like, if you had asked John Lennon what he thought about Gene Vincent, he would have been happy to tell you.
Oh, he loved Gene Vincent.
I just don't think anyone asked them, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't You know, when we met the, you know, the Rolling Stones and George, of course, they knew all this stuff, you know, and that's why they liked the Stray Cats. They couldn't, you know, we were like the real thing to a bunch of those older guys, especially the English guys, you know. They like really saw it. They
right.
got it.
And I think part of that, because that's your foundation, I think, you know, from the outside of the Stray Cats, I can say this. That's why the music holds up today more so than other things that are kind of, you know, the novelty hits that came out of that same era, which were,
sure.
which were not the same kind of music. But, you know, when people think about the early 80s, there's the music, and then there's the novelty songs that kind of came out at the same time. People go, ho, I remember the 80s. And but you
right.
guys had the chops, and your foundation was the, you know, the granddaddies of rock and roll. And you know, it was great to see
yeah.
it come back.
Yeah, and like again, and I this is what I tried to revisit in you know, the overall view of my book with that. I started this whole thing because I, and like to think we, loved rockabilly music and loved playing and loved the image and loved this thing. And, you know, that we've had a life from it and made a little bit of dent and made it. Now it's up to some other band to carry the torch. I mean, we've had our hit records and now you have a life and all that, you know. But we kind of gave it the chance to continue. Because if the Stray Cats hadn't had a hit record, like, we used to call, you're the same age, AM hits.
Yeah.
You know?
Sure.
You know, the Rolling Stones had them. The Beatles, they had FM hit that crossed over to AM. Now
mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's one that's in common from the charts. But
well, yeah,
even
the
in
industry's
the 80s,
so
you know,
weird.
In the 80s, maybe early 90s, there was like a, you could have an AM hit, right? And the Stray Cats had a few of them. And that's the only way that you can really be, lack of a better word, legendary kind of thing. You know, you had to have a hit song.
Yep.
And I think if the Stray Cats hadn't had hit songs, like everyone knows Rock This Town. You can go to the Amazon jungle and sing Rock This Town. They're going to know it. You know, so it's that kind
it's
of
true.
Thing. Those, and we have a few of those. You know, the Beatles have the most. The Stones have the second most. Elvis has, you know, like, you have to have a few of those.
Right.
To really, you know, write a book, you know, to have a book written about you. I don't know if rockabilly would have continued. It would have been like a, you know, a dead language.
Yeah.
And that's what I can really take pride in, and that this is, you know, now it's up to the rest of them. And I think now there's a little bit of a movement, and there's Hot Rod and Tattoo and
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Our culture. So it's going to continue to a certain extent, you know, but I don't know if it would have.
You know, that's a tough call. And with you guys being as visible and as well produced and like I said, the music holds up. It's hard to say what would have happened if it had been three other guys who didn't have the chops that you did, who just had, you know, guitars and haircuts. I don't think it would have caught on. You know, like you guys are used to, you had your Hamburg days, you know, where you played five sets a day for, you know, you put in your 10,000 hours. And I think a lot of that is why it holds up. And, you know, you were mentioning AM hits. Rock This Town sounds really good on an AM radio. It was like, it's well produced. It's a great record, but if you compress it and play it on AM radio, it sounds like it belongs on AM radio too. And it's like one of the last hits that really sounds like that.
I believe I put in the book strongly enough how important Edmonds was, Dave Edmonds, who was kind of a bit in the story, not to compare yourself to one that big, but he was a little bit like Sam Phillips, who was waiting for Elvis Presley to come along, kind of thing. Dave Edmunds really knew and loved this music and knew how he wanted it to sound. I think if we had gotten the wrong producer, we didn't really know. Like, we were kids. I think Brian knew how he wanted his guitar to sound. He was an intuitive guy and all that. But, like, about miking a drum or, you know, as long as you could hear the drum, that's what I knew. Like, like you put a mic on the singing. That's all that you know, nobody really knew, right, to be honest with you. So, Edmunds was really the, you know, he knew, and he came to see us and said, let me do it before someone else does it incorrectly, you know. And we went in, and then the label agreed to, you know, because everyone wanted to produce it. It was like a very much in vogue in the moment thing, the Stray Cats. In London, 1980, they wanted to get the record out before Christmas, you know, so we had to do it quick, you know.
Right.
And I didn't know any of this, of course. Now you look back and see how the business is. They wanted to really seize the moment, and Edmunds was there. He wanted to do it, and the label agreed to him, so we, you know, we had to get and do it. It had to be, you know, we had kind of maxed out the little bit of fame that you're going to get from playing in the pubs and, you know, having cool people come to the show. We had to actually, because this was only in London, you know, there was the rest of the country and then the rest of the world, but everything we were doing was very London-centric, so... So Dave knew it, and we went in the studio like 2 days later and cut Runaway Boys, so, and Rock the Town and Stray Cats all in the same week.
Yeah.
Again, we knew that set inside out, so we basically did the live set in the studio.
And he was definitely the right man for the job. Now, do you remember doing Fridays?
Yeah, I remember it very well.
Tell me about that.
When I did the Fridays, okay. Do the people know what Fridays was?
Was ABC Saturday Night Live, and the cast included Larry David, Michael Richards, and it was kind of a underground kind of alternative to Saturday Night Live kind of feel. I was watching the night you guys came on.
Okay, now the guy who was the booker for the show was on a holiday or a vacation in London,
right,
and saw the band play. He was, you know, it was a little bit of good luck, you know.
Right.
I guess we would have had to have been good the night that he, you know, booked. The Clash had done it. So they had musical guests like they did on SNL. But again, it's all very record company based. You know, you have to have a song on the radio, and you have to have a label to fly you over. You have to have someone to pay the hotel bill, and then you get someone that brings the gear there. And it's all involved with the label kind of thing. There's a reason for it. Like, you go to the radio station, the girl from the thing takes you to the newspaper, and you do the, you know, it's a bit of a system.
Right.
So this guy came to see, was in London on his vacation, and I guess he was into seeing bands, saw the Stray Cats, I have to have this, right? So went back to the States, and our record hadn't been released in America.
Right.
We found out a little bit later it had been played a little bit on the import show on K-Rock, Import Alley,
right,
the show in the 80s that would play, you know, whatever it was to, you know, the band from England kind of thing. So because they got it on an import. So this guy went back to the States and went to the ABC people and told them that we were the biggest band and this and that and the other, and that if they're fine, okay, who do we call the label? How do we get this set up? We didn't have anybody. It was just us, basically, three, you know, children somehow in the world by ourselves.
Right.
So he somehow promised the TV network that if they booked us, that the next week, because it was the same manager, they would get, it was like Journey or some huge band.
Right.
Right? That they promised to put an unknown band who didn't even have a record out. They have to think about this. Going on, imagine getting on Saturday Night Live with a band that didn't have a record.
You'd have to be
American
amazing.
Band, or even American Bandstand, right? You have to have a record. So this guy believed in us, and it was the wacky days back then. We bluffed our way, right? And we came to L.A., and through the import and the player, well, we didn't know any of this. We had kind of had a following without knowing it. So they booked a show at the Roxy to try to, like, pay for the hotel that we was had to stay in while we were doing Fridays. And that quickly turned into we did the Roxy for, I think, 5 days. An afternoon show and an evening show. Maybe it was the same 300 people came to every show. I don't know. But there was, and I'd never been to L.A. before. I'd been to Paris, you know, we had been to Tokyo, but I'd never been to L.A. And I just never left after that first time. So we did Fridays and did the Roxy to pay for it. Again, we still didn't have a record contract in America. And the Roxy was just an amazing memory. You know, I think Jack Nicholson came, you know, and like, I just remember, you know, someone took me to the Rainbow and we went upstairs on the Roxy and we were living at the Sunset Marquee, you know, doing the laundry in the basement, and Chrissy Hynde was there. It was just a fantastic time, you know, walking to the Sunset Strip from the Sunset Marquee. And, you know, years and I just loved L.A. and I just never left. And then years later, I lived on Sunset Strip. I owned a nightclub, but it became very much my universe.
Right.
But the first time was when we did the Roxy, and because of Fridays. So we did Fridays, and if you were there, so you remember being in your living room, and on Friday night, and the Stray Cats come on the TV. We were like children with tattoos, and really looked mean, and we're probably smoking on stage, and like the whole thing.
Yep.
Believing it 100%, because that's we were really into it.
Right.
And again, it was another one of those things where national TV live. There's no backing track. You play live on national TV, and you pretty much your whole life depends on this show.
Right.
And it was like, okay, what you mean? Just go and play the songs? Yes. Okay, great. And then we went to some party at Michael Richards, you know, house afterwards or something, who years later I met, and I didn't remember any of this, you know. At the time, again, it was just something you did that day.
Right.
You know, that's what you did that day. They told you to go here and do this, and that's what we did. And again, I don't even really remember having much guidance, you know. You know, there was maybe a I don't even think we had a manager at that time. We just somehow did things.
You guys were just the Three Musketeers.
I can't quite remember it more than that.
Yeah.
But years later, and this is kind of cool, at the Rolling Stones show, when Bill Clinton gave the thing, they gave away the tickets kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was like a Earth Day thing. Okay. So a bunch of us had got tickets. And so we're going to the – and I went right back. I saw Charlie, Ronnie Wood's wife, Josephine, at the time. She said, hey, this is Stray Cats kid. Come on back. And we just went and, you know, had run of the whole place. And then we went to our seats, and I'm with, you know, the girlfriend at the time and a couple guys from the Cat Club band. And it was like, don't worry, I'll take care of everything. And it really worked, you know.
Right.
So we're going into our seats, and someone puts their legs up and blocks, you know, when you're walking down the aisle in an arena.
Right.
And – it was Larry David. And he said, remember me? He was trying to be cool in front of his friends, like he knew the Rock and Rollers, I think, you know. And he was like, hey, remember Fridays? And, oh, yeah, how you doing, buddy, you know. And he just wanted to kind of grill me in front of his friends for a few minutes, and then he let me pass, you know. But at the time, who would have known that those guys would have done that kind of work? You know, and they're fantastic. And Seinfeld went to our high school, same as Stray Cats, so another small twist of irony to that story.
That's really amazing. You know, there are a lot of great stories in this book, and there's a lot of really, you know, I hate to use the term lucky because I don't want to diminish the amount of work and talent that you guys put into it, but, you know, L.A. is full of people who have put in a lot of work and have a lot of talent who just don't get the break. And, you know, you guys were at the right place, the right time, the right look.
Sure.
Everything just kind of came together for you. And I got to the end of the book and I'm like, this guy's had an awesome life. Usually at the end of a biography, I'll ask the guy who wrote it, you know, if you could go back and tell 19-year-old Jim Phantom some advice to carry him through his adult life to make it easier, what would you tell him? And I'm like, this guy probably doesn't have anything to say because he lucked his way through
everything. You know, invest your money and, you know, buy like Apple stock, defer the money from the US Festival into Apple stock. That's what I would tell somebody.
The US Festival.
Don't take the money from the US Festival. Just tell the guy, could we just have it in stock instead, mister? That's what I would tell someone. Besides that end of it all, which no kids really know.
Right.
You know, it's been awesome. And it's just because playing rockabilly music and being genuine about it. And I do think that if we started right now, if we were 19 years old, the Stray Cats would make it again.
Oh yeah,
I have no doubt. I have no doubt in that, because it was really in the same way that Elvis would make it, and the Sex Pistols would make it, and the Clash would make it, and Led Zeppelin would make it. I think there are certain groups within a genre that are special, that it transcends the actual time.
Yeah,
that, you know, that you're in. Like, it's good in the 50s. It's good in the 80s. It's good right now. You know, that's my own.
Well, yeah.
Feeling about the band.
Well, I think the reason that rockabilly endures is because there's something just spiritually transcendent about the rock and roll that just grabs you by the sternum and shakes you and just and you know, everybody's got those records that makes the hair on their arm stand up, you know.
Yes.
And whether it's 20 Flight Rock or it's Sweet Little 16 or it's Sexy and 17, you know, whatever.
Every time.
You know, there it is. And that's, I think that's what was really missing when you guys burst on the scene, you know?
And I think what, maybe not as much in the States as it should be, because sometimes you ignore, like, isn't the weather great today in L.A.? Sometimes you miss it because you're right there, kind of thing. But
yeah.
I know around the world, rockabilly represents the best part of America that the rest of the world love. Say whatever they want. They can say, you know, American culture is loved all over the world. They love it in every country in the world. Of course, a few bad guys, whatever. But like the representation of America, they love Cadillac, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, jukeboxes, Harley Davidson, Corvette, Playmates. You know,
right.
They love it.
Sideburns and hamburgers,
rockabilly,
right?
Rock and roll, rockabilly represents all of the great things about America. And that's what the rest of the world wants America to be great. Really, like you go to anywhere, Australia, Brazil, Finland, Tokyo, the people love this, you know? If you drive a Cadillac in any major city on planet Earth, people will say, wow, that's so cool.
Right.
See? And that's what it is, you know? People are rooting for America.
Cool is
not.
Cool,
that's
man.
What I feel, you know, and that's American cool, and that's the. And after all these years of looking back at it, I really think that it's a great positive representation of America.
See, and that's, you know, that's what you'll take away from the book when you check it out. Is really there's no more American 20th century American art form than rock and roll, and
yeah.
Jim's kind of lived it.
Jazz and the blues, and you know,
yeah, and it all comes from that same core. And cool is cool,
yeah.
But the man lived a rock and roll lifestyle. He dated stars. He you know, opened for the Stones. He hangs out. He's friends with Beatles, and all that stuff is in this book, man. What do you want people to walk away from the book thinking about Slim Jim Phantom?
Well, you know. You know, he's a pretty cool guy. Let's go to his gig and, you know, make a, you know, I'm trying to stay out of the club. You know, let's book him on a nice festival. He can go on at 5 o'clock in the afternoon and, you know, I really, you know, wrote it just to have the story told a little bit, you know, and to really make the connection, you know, between all these kind of people, really to make connections. That's the whole thing. Like, no one's going to really know without delving more than an inch into it that Lemmy, his favorite guy was Buddy Holly. You know, the Sex Pistols come from Jerry Lee Lewis. You know, that everyone's connected. There's not a separation of this is, you know, the English music, and this is punk rock, and this is, you know, the 60s, and this is, it's really kind of more connected than that. And I've kind of been through rockabilly music and through being, you know, me, we kind of stride a bunch of different fences.
Yeah.
Like, I was just in England over the summertime, and I played the 80s Rewind Fest with Adam Ant and ABC, and it was awesome, you know. We had fun. I leave the door open, everyone says hello. And then I did the Punk Rock Rebellion Festival with the Exploited and Anti-Nowhere League and, you know, the Damned. And again, I was welcome to go. Anyone with a mohawk who's left in the world was at this thing. It was 10,000 people. And then I did a rockabilly one.
Right.
You know, that's, this music is kind of, and then hyper into that, the Stray Cats, straddle a bunch of fences. And that's what I kind of, you know, that's the overall message, is that, you know, it's connection and everyone should, you know.
A couple more questions.
Along, right?
Just a sure. Couple more and we'll wrap it up. You have encountered...
I'm into this.
What, man?
I said, I'm here. I'm not going out there.
Beautiful.
You know, yeah, so,
well, no, believe me, I'd love to hang out, but, you know, that's how it is. You encountered a lot of people. There's a lot of names in this book without being name-droppy. You're just telling stories about your life, which is awesome. Who are the people that came up to you and go, I love what you do, that just blew your mind? Just absolutely blew your flipping mind. You're like, really? You?
That's a good question, because I always thought it was good. I was always more like, why wouldn't someone like it? again, like, you know, George, you know, in the room with the Beatles, that was a big one, you know, and like, I just went up to him, you know, and again, it's a little bit like the hot chick at the dance. No one says anything. She's going to be by herself, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not saying I have that much nerve, but like a couple times in your life, you kind of have to do something, or you know you're going to regret it for 5 years, you know?
Right.
So we were doing this TV show, and it was very much, you know, George was doing his thing, and he came and went, and Lee and I were the rhythm section, and I mean, it could have come and gone, where, hey, kid, you play the drums good? Okay, mister, thanks, you know? But I actually went up to him and said, dude, I think he liked that part of it, you know? And kind of, I knew they liked rockabilly music, and I always thought that rockabilly was, you know, like a good... you know, good unifier with all that. I don't really. I was never surprised that anyone liked it.
Right.
You know, to the average guy in the street that doesn't know, like Lemmy, I suppose. You know, but he was a very intuitive guy. He loved punk rock. He loved jazz. He loved the blues. He loved it. So sometimes your perception of someone isn't what you think it's going to be.
Yeah.
But you and me, we're in this business to hold. Those are the only people that you know. Those. This is who you know. It's not. Seeking them out. It's this is who you know.
Yeah.
And you know, Britt was awesome, you know, she was like a glamorous, you know, movie star, and again she had never heard of the Stray Cats, and I didn't know who she was. We just had a connection. So that was a bit of a lucky one, you know.
Yeah, but, those are great stories. The story of how you guys got together is really a great story in the
yeah.
book. So let's move forward. Where do we see Slim Jim Phantom moving forward? You know, you're gonna continue doing festivals and stuff, but I'd imagine there's, you know, you've got that creative streak. You know, is there new stuff?
Well, writing the book was hard.
Yeah, I bet.
I'd like to write another one. Again, part of I don't go there naturally in my head, but to say anything bad about anybody, you can pretty much do that once as well.
Yeah.
Hate everything, and this thing happened, and that happened. You can really just do that once, and maybe, you know, some talk show radio host would like you to do something like that. You know, but. That's not a future way forward. And in rock and roll, and then especially being the drummer, it's all about the next gig. You know, you're trying to keep it all going, you know. The thing I hope is that, the guys in the band, we hook it all up, you know. And like, it's really everyone's scheduling and, you know, lives. But there's still a lot of interest in it. And that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to end that on a whole positive note, you know.
Yeah.
Go and play, earn what it's worth, and just be like, have like a positive legacy, I think. And, you know, like the books, just like to have easier things. I'd like to stay home more, you know. And you're in L.A. You love L.A.
I do.
I like to hike my little dog and go to, you know, lunch in Beverly Hills. You know what I mean? And, you know, look at the girls and, you know, just have a little bit of an easier time. But, you know, I like traveling. I was just in England for the summertime. I said I played like a bunch of festivals, and I played drums for my other good buddy, Glenn Matlock.
Right.
As his drummer, we did a bunch of shows. We made an album. That's going to come out next year.
Wow.
I'd like to do an album, which, again, it's everyone's scheduling is really the hardest thing. We do a band called the Jack Tars, which is Captain Sensible, The Damned, myself, Chris Chaney from an awesome band called The Living End, Australian kind of band that the Stray Cats influenced. Now he's in his 40s, so and like it doesn't matter. But when he was, you know, 17, I was 21. And, like,
right.
He came to see us, and now they're, like, huge pop stars. And Mike Peters from The Alarm. We have a band. And
that is a really interesting group of guys.
Yeah. Yeah, Mikey Boy, Chris Chaney, Captain Sensible, and me. And we have a bunch of songs. It's a matter of getting everyone in. We almost did it in L.A. We did Troubadour a couple of years ago, or maybe last year. And again, a wacky gang, you know, does it. That was the core of it. Augmented by Duff McKagan, who's one of our good buddies, and Portlandia.
Oh, yeah.
Fred Armisen, who's your neighbor up there in Eagle Rock somewhere.
Yep.
Fred is from our old neighborhood.
No kidding.
We've connected. Yeah, he's from Valley Stream, and he saw the Stray Cats play among those early bar gigs. So he's, you know, big, you know, he's a very successful, really funny comedian, did SNL for a long time, and I was at Portlandia, and he does a thing with us. So, again, I would like to make a record that we've been trying to make with that little combo of guys. But life takes over.
Right.
You know, Guns N' Roses, everyone who started to play, and the Damned are doing the 40th anniversary of punk, big thing, you know. Chaney just had a record come out in Australia that got to number 4 in the charts, I think. Portlandia is a huge show, but it's really just finding everyone's time. That's the record I'd like to do.
Yeah.
And then this record with Glenn and me. So there'll be enough to do, I think, you know.
Very, very cool.
I like doing radio.
Well, then let's hang
no
out. Let's do more podcasts, man.
Yeah, no one's got a show that really does, you know, that links rockabilly to the whole thing. Like, my thing is, if you like the Beatles, you have to like Carl Perkins. If you like The Who, you have to like Eddie Cochran, and just make that connection to everything. You
right.
know? Still trying to convince the same knuckleheads that we went to high school with, you know what I mean, that there's more to life than, you know, flare jeans and, you know, long hair. still fighting that fight in a funny way. Maybe it's my problem, you know?
Yep.
Still trying to convince everyone, you know?
Yeah.
So, just, you know, have an easier time of it all. That's all.
That's rock and roll, man. You're perpetually fighting the fight you fight at 17. But now, you know, we're up there and we're like, oh, man, I'd rather take a nap sometimes. But
yeah, but you see, now I like everybody. I love Journey. I think they're amazing, you know what I mean?
Right.
You know, like when you're a punk rocker or a rockabilly, you had to have a little bit of a thing. But now what you learn, and I think that's in there because I was so young, you learn we're all in this fantastic game together, you know what I mean? It's like we're all in it.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. There are
I like every type of music. Every band, every drummer, everyone's kind of cool, you know. There's varying degrees of how much the, you know, the hair on your arm stands up, but like every, you know, the idea that we're all still all doing it is pretty, you know, it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I've got a good friend who says that, you know, every record, no matter what it is, every record has something good in it. No matter, even if it's like the dumbest Fabian cut, you know, there's something good in it. And
every drummer is, to me, I have a whole chapter, my little appendix of my book is all about every drummer is cool.
Yeah, you know? And there's some great guys in here, and there's some guys I want to check out now that I've read the list. There's, I'm like, okay, no. Oh, now I got to look into this. So,
you know, it's all kind of a human experience. You know, live music is, and again, some of it, nothing quite moves me like Bebop Alula. Still to this day, I pull over to the side of the road if it comes, you know, like certain things are a little bit different, you know, that level that it still kind of moves me. But I can go see any gig, and if it's not too loud, you know, that's the only thing that kind of gives me a, you know, pain in the ear. But like, besides that, I like everything, you know, live music.
What's the last live show you attended as an audience member?
Well, it was good over the summertime because with Glenn we did a few. I just did a festival just a couple days ago with Adamant, ABC, Annabella, who's my old friend, was on it.
Right.
Toya Wilcox, Midgeur from Ultravox, and had a great time. And then before that, I did a show. It was The Damned, TSOL, Anti Nowhere League, Transgenders, and I hang around and watch the bands, you know. Everyone's, you know.
Very, very cool.
And then Glenn and I were on some festival that there was a bunch of young people. There was a band called the Rotten Hill Gang, and there was a band called the Pins, who were all girls who were fantastic, like the Go-Go's or the Bangles, but like with heavy chops.
Really?
The Pins. Yeah. They were awesome. Like hot chicks in short skirts and like the girls playing like John Bonham. It was really good. So that was just a few weeks ago, you know, and again, I hope I remember it, and, you know, a month from now when someone asks me again, but I always go back to, you know, the Sun Session, second Gene Vincent album, you know, After School Session, Chuck Berry, and,
yep,
you know, Dixie Fried, and that's it.
That's where it all starts. The book is called A Stray Cat Strut, My Life as a Rockabilly Rebel. It's on Thomas Dunn Books by St. Martin's Press. It is wherever you get your books. My guest has been Slim Jim Phantom, drummer extraordinaire, 80s icon, and all-around swell guy, and now my new friend. So
yeah, well, Book Soup, we're doing Book Soup on Wednesday.
Yep, I'll be there.
At 7 o'clock. Oh, great! So we can just you know, introduce yourself, and I'd love to come on the show. And I'm when I'm around in L.A.,
yeah,
which I try to be more. I like going out. I like hanging out with everybody, and we goof off, and we.
All right, brother.
It's always something to do.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.